There he is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am here today to introduce Senate File 752.
Good morning.
Would you like me to move the file, Mr. Chair?
No, not yet. Well, let's go ahead and with the explanation, but maybe you could tell me, just so committee members know that this bill, it does have a fiscal note, and the motion will ultimately be to send it to finance. Transportation first, then finance, is that correct? Okay, so the motion will be for transportation. Senator Daines, go ahead and explain your bill.
Senate File 752 is a bill that relates to insurance providing for the establishment of an online motor vehicle insurance verification system. If we kind of go through the bill here.
It's really busy.
If we get into page 2, section 2, that's kind of where we really get into the meat of the bill. It talks about the rulemaking, which would allow the department to adopt rules for online verification. Subdivision 2 talks about the status. It's the opportunity to provide online verification of evidence of insurance system that is adopted by the department by rule and is the sole and exclusive system for reporting and verifying evidence of insurance. Section 3, the operation goes into the verification system must be capable of sending requests for insurers for verification. Also talks about the appropriate provisions for securing the data and that the system must be used for verification of evidence of mandatory liability insurance. And then we get into the next page. We go down to Subdivision 4. It talks about response time. Subdivision 5 talks about the department's power. When the department has reason to believe a motor vehicle has been or is currently being operated without insurance, it gives the department's power what they can do there. It talks about consulting. The department needs to consult with the insurance industry and other service providers in setting this program up and determining the rules and guidelines. And then Section 8 talks about the contacts, about the department and its private service provider. If any, must maintain a contact person for insurers during establishment, implementation, and operation of the system. Then we go to the next page, and we talk about compliance and then record keeping, and point out that this would not apply to commercial vehicles. And then the authority for the department to contract with private service provider, that's Subdivision 14. And then Subdivision 15 talks about the fees. The department may impose a fee on each new and renewal vehicle registration. So when people go in and get their license, they would pay a fee, and that fee would be used to pay for this process. And then we have on Section 3, it's outlined a time period for to report back once it's been implemented and how well it's doing. I do have an amendment to introduce, and I apologize. I should have introduced that amendment right away to start with. That is the A1 amendment, and that is an author's amendment, and I move that amendment at this time.
Okay, we'll go ahead and pass it out first if we give folks a chance to at least look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, members, Senator Daines moves an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. And the motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted.
Thank you. And with me today, I have Mr. Bob Johnson that will be testifying, and Alyssa Schlander, excuse me if I get that name mispronounced, from Minnesota Auto Dealers and Bobbitts from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Senator Danz, before you do that, did you want to explain what the A1 Amendment did? I know we adopted it, but it, did it change anything significantly in the bill?
Here's what the A1 and I apologize for that, Mr. Chair. Here's what the A1 Amendment does. The A1 Amendment will allow insurance carriers to be able to use the electronic format for insurance, providing proof of insurance versus the cards that we currently have now. So once this program is adopted, the insurance identification card may be provided in electronic format if the insured agrees. So that would eliminate a lot of paperwork that the insurance companies are doing now. It also eliminates the opportunity for somebody to come in right now and purchase insurance from their local agent. They receive a card in the mail. It's a six-month card. 2 months later, they stop paying for the policy, yet they have a card that shows they have insurance. So we go to an online system, which would be time active.
And Senator Danz, and also you have a repealer, Section 65B.482. What is that that's repealing?
Okay, what that is doing is it's changing the dates. If you look in the original bill, this bill, we did not hear it last year, but it was drawn up last year. Oh, and so the dates are 1 year off. So what this does is changes the dates.
Okay, but Senator Danz, but what something is repealed? I see the date change. What is Section 65B.482 that's being repealed as part of your bill?
Yes, and what that does is it repeals the insurance card program that we currently have in statute and replaces it with the electronic identification.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, thank you. I wanted to just give a little bit of context for the bill then and just a little background description on it. And it is an initiative that we've taken to the legislature. This is a model bill of a group that I don't think anybody here has ever heard of before. It's the IICMVA. But what that is, Insurance Industry Committee on Motor Vehicle Administration. It's those people within the insurance industry that work with the verification systems around the country. And all states have mandatory compulsory auto, and they all have some sort of system forcing that. And that, Mr. Chairman and committee members, really the bill is here for really the primary reason is that as we look at our mandatory compulsory auto insurance law in Minnesota and then ask the question, what should we be doing to ensure greater compliance with that? We know that there is a growing number of Minnesotans who are driving without car insurance. We believe as an industry, based on industry estimates, it's somewhere between 500,000 and 600,000 cars are on the road of Minnesota today, and they are being driven without car insurance. So that is a crime under the current state law, and I think the fair question to ask is, what should we be doing to ensure greater compliance? We're not changing any of the criminal penalties, so there are specific statutes that give specific dollar penalties. What Senate File 752 is intended to do is to, frankly, modernize the process so that we would have in utilization in this state, again, a web-based system, online verification, that we believe it's more efficient, it's more cost-effective, it's vendor neutral. There's no leaning towards any vendor selection. And frankly, it provides real-time verification at the times when I believe the state and law enforcement wants the verification of the coverage. So if there's a traffic stop and the police officer wants to know at that moment, does this driver have car insurance, this is a system that's intended to give law enforcement the real-time, when they need it, verification. The other systems, the paper systems, the ones that we have had historically, they were an earlier time, had a kind of a checkered history of their effectiveness, and that's still a common debate point. But we just believe that a system that's event-based, so again, whether there's a traffic stop, there's an accident, maybe even at the time of a vehicle registration, we would have the ability as a state, as law enforcement, to take a check and get an instant verification whether or not that individual has auto insurance as required. So for our industry, this issue and this system is being debated around the country. States are, I don't have the list here, there's a half a dozen states that have moved to this web-based verification. There's a half a dozen states that are running pilot projects to test it. And so we're committed as an industry to working with you, with law enforcement, again, in Minnesota, to put in place a more cost-effective way to do this. I had talked yesterday. I don't know if they were able to come today. I know the Minnesota Police Chief supports the bill. I know that the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee of Hennepin County and the City of Minneapolis, which is an all-encompassing group of the Minneapolis Police Chief and prosecutors and law enforcement, I know the CJCC supports the bill. So I think it's reflective of, again, law enforcement, prosecutors, the industry looking for tools to just more cost-effectively implement. There's I'm not conversant enough in kind of the details of how the web-based system would operate. The Senate File 752, again, references that Model Act. It's a Model Act that has had a lot of time worked on it between the industry and the motor vehicle administrators, you know, around the country. And it's still a work in progress. So that, Mr. Chairman, is the testimony in support of that part of the bill, the amendment that Senator Dames put on the bill. The first one, you may remember a year ago, we had some legislation. We're really constantly looking for those specific state statutes that we can update that recognize how a growing number of consumers in Minnesota do their insurance business, which is electronically. The point of the matter is that these ID cards today have to be pieces of paper. All of you get those pieces of paper. And many consumers would like to just get that on their iPhone, get it electronically. It's not a secured card, it's just a piece of paper. And so from our perspective, this just recognizes, and they have to agree to that. If they don't want it, we'll continue to print it. But for those that say, please send it to me, then we'll send it in electronic format. And the repealer of that statute, I think, recognizes that if we can get to the web-based online verification system, this actually puts in place then, and I think as a state, we can continue to have the discussion of what should be the criminal penalties, what should be the dollar penalties if you're driving without insurance. But we're not addressing that in the legislation. I know other committees have jurisdiction over that. So we think then repealing the ID cards, once the system is in place, then we would then have an enforcement mechanism that we think is far more effective, far more cost-effective, and just more efficient in doing the job when we need to have it done, which is, again, when there's accidents or traffic stops. So that, Mr. Chairman, is my testimony on the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I have a question first, and I don't know if Senator Dames can answer this or Mr. Johnson, but what would happen if there's no insurance? They pull it up, you're not insured. I'm sorry, you can't renew your tabs. That person says, okay, thank you, I guess goodbye, walks out the door, and then the deputy registrar just waves goodbye as the uninsured motorist drives away? How is that normally handled? There is a person that is breaking the law, they know that, and away they go. Is there anything, any obligations for anybody to report anything, or how does that work?
Well, keep in mind that in the state of Minnesota previously, when you went in to renew your license, get your tabs renewed, you had to prove insurance.
Right.
That is no longer the case
right.
Today. Today it's done randomly. So if I go into the local DMV and get my new tabs, they're not going to ask about my insurance because that's done randomly, so there's no issue there. What this bill really does is when the Highway Patrol picks somebody up or stops somebody, they would find if they have insurance at that point in time. And what this will do, in my opinion, is people are going to realize that there's going to be a method now of real-time tracking who does and does not have insurance. So if I'm driving down the road without insurance and my taillight is out and they pick me up, they run my license plate number. That's going to indicate if I have insurance or not.
Okay.
And at that point in time, then I have violated that law,
okay.
And I'm up for prosecution for driving without insurance.
Okay.
Also, I think that what that will do is it will encourage a lot of those folks now that know how the system works and know how to get around it
mm-hmm.
to start buying insurance or keep those vehicles off the road.
Okay. Then I guess I was misunderstood. I thought there was a deputy registrar component in this. Has there been any thought of expanding this to the deputy registrars to not renew tabs if you're not insured?
Well, this bill.
Have you had some of those discussions or to go back to the way we had it? Or I know this bill doesn't cover that, but I'm just curious, because I know you're trying to attack this problem.
Mr. Chair and members, I have not had that discussion with anybody. If that should be brought up or not, it's certainly something that could be added once the system is in place. It would be a very simple system. I mean, you wouldn't need to bring a proof of insurance card to the DMV. They would just have it right on the computer.
Okay.
And it certainly could be a possibility, but we have not had that discussion.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that's it. We've never had a situation where you can get real-time verification at the desk or in the squad car, yay or nay, on insurance in place. So I think that's a legitimate issue as we go forward.
Okay. All right.
See, and the purpose, Mr. Chair and members, the purpose of the bill is to try to get the number of uninsured people that are driving on the road, to try to reduce that number. If you have an accident and the party that is at fault is uninsured, it's a costly experience for you, because if you don't have your car insured, you're going to be responsible to take care of the car because they don't have insurance, and chances are probably not a method of paying for your damages. Everything comes back to your uninsured, uninsured as far as medical after you reach exceed your limits on PIP. So it's getting to be very costly. So what we're doing is we have a faction of folks that are driving without insurance, yet their costs are out there, so it's driving up the insurance premium on the folks that are insuring themselves. So at the end of the day, we should do two things. One is that the number of folks driving uninsured should be decreased, or the number of vehicles on the road should be decreased. And also, we should actually decrease the cost of insurance per vehicle, because we'll have more folks insured, and our claims probably won't change much.
Okay. Mr. Schlander, you wanted to speak.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We're the trade association that represents all of the franchise new car dealers in the state of Minnesota. I just wanted to be on the record to weigh in about our concerns about how this program is paid for. Obviously, from the description, it seems as though the policy moves in the right direction, and that this is a good thing to, make use of readily available technology that would be of assistance to law enforcement. However, to pay for this bill, and I understand that there's a section in the bill that has an unspecified new fee on motor vehicle registrations, and I just wanted the committee to consider that Minnesota right now, the taxes and fees on a motor vehicle sale are anywhere from 30% to 150% higher than all of our surrounding states. There are at least 10 separate taxes and fees that accompany the sale of a motor vehicle right now. So adding another one is a serious concern for our industry, as worthy as this program is. Now, I've talked with Mr. Johnson and Senator Dames about this. I understand that the bill was introduced as a model act, and that there's probably some development that needs to happen before the bill, actually gets to the floor. But as I said, I just wanted to be on the record with our concerns about the fact that we're adding another tax on the sale of motor vehicles.
Okay. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dames, I share Ms. Schlander's concern, because I do all the time hear from people with regard to their annoyance at the fees that they're charged. Do you have any other ideas?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I'm sure there are other options out there. I just feel that it is an option that pertains to the vehicles, and that's probably why we've went that direction to do the fee on the license tabs. But I'm certainly, there are other options out there, and certainly willing to look at other options as to how this could be paid for.
Okay. Other questions? All right, Senator Dames, you're giving the Department of Public Safety rulemaking authority. Is this maybe Senator Rest can help me with that? If it's a rulemaking authority, does this need to go to the state and local government committee?
Yes.
Generally, it certainly has in the past. You're going to want to check with the chairman of that committee. May need another stop after transportation.
I would just suggest to the author too that. He makes sure that the Senator Dimsey understands that, so that the bill does not get hung up waiting in transportation and then end up being beyond the deadline. I mean, I don't know that it ought to go there first, but the rules clearly say it has to. Our own rules say it has to clearly go. And I would not suggest deleting it, the rulemaking authority, and then putting it back on later in order to bypass state government committee. If you do that, I certainly will inform Senator Perry, but I would assume that you would not try that.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dames, I do have a concern on subsection 15 on the fees on this bill, line 5.27. Are we going to leave it up to the department to decide what that fee would be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown.
Senator Dames.
I'm not just sure how we're going to do that, but right now we don't have a number to plug in. And I think what we would see is that once we find out what the actual cost and stuff is going to be, then we can negotiate the correct fee. We don't have a load in there. We don't want a fee that's loaded. We want a fee that's an accurate fee for the cost of performing this service.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, so if this moves forward, this will go to a finance committee who can grill you heavily on this issue?
And I'm sure that they, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'm sure they will.
All right,
yes,
thank
it
you.
Would.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, if I could just supplement that with just a couple of sentences, that we are looking at the states that have adopted it. And while a couple of them are smaller states than ours population-wise, the costs have been surprisingly small for the, and we really don't know. We need to have some tough budgeters look at the actual, but we're going to get the examples of the states that have implemented it. And I would just tell you, it's been, I consider it relatively smaller kind of programming people time to put together, because the technology is all there. It's just making the connections and the IP addresses, and kind of the coordination to make it all happen. So that will be part of the discussion on what's needed, you know, to implement it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, if this committee, you know, I think if we actually looked at the numbers in terms of what our fees are compared to our surrounding states, and if this committee decided that we didn't think that was the right way to pay for it, then one thing we could do is, you know, I could offer an amendment to delete that section, and then at your subsequent committees, you'd have to figure out another way to pay for it. That would be one option. It's your bill. With the way that it is, I'm not going to support your bill, but, you know, you probably have enough support here to move forward. But if you were open to that, I'd be happy to offer that amendment, and then, you know, you'd have that challenge to figure out another way to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, at this point, I probably would not accept that as a friendly amendment.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions from the committee members? Hey, let me ask if there's anybody from the audience that would like to speak on the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And certainly we've been involved at the national level with the group that's working on these verification systems for vehicle insurance through our division, division's participation. And we certainly understand the need for us to be able to verify insurance, but I need to also inform the committee that right now we're in the development of our Minnesota licensing and registration system, and we aren't expecting that to be done until 2016. And that would be the earliest that we would be able to begin implementation of this system. Our current system is too fragile to do the type of programming that would be necessary for implementing this bill. And so I just wanted to go on the record before the committee that this is not a project that at this point in time we would be able to undertake.
Thank you. Okay, is there anybody else in the audience who would like to speak on the bill? Then seeing none, Senator Dames moves that. Roll call has been requested. So the clerk or whatever your title would be in this capacity, will take the roll. So Senator Brown, yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little troubled by this, and I just want to make sure that if I vote yes for this, that there will be continued discussion about this fee increase. I don't like the idea of fee increases.
Okay. I think that's a question for Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, as this progresses through the committees, we certainly will have a discussion. We could certainly have discussions on how other options for this to be paid for. Mm-hmm. And as I stated earlier, right now, I have not had that discussion with anybody, so I don't have any other options, and I don't want you to believe that I do. I don't, but I'm certainly willing to look at other options.
Thank you.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff had asked Senator Dames about an amendment to remove
transportation. Fees,
and I don't know where those sections are, but I know this time.
Okay, Senator Rest would like to make a motion, which is subdivision 15, I believe, and Mr. Stang will correct me if I'm wrong on that, but we're looking at, it looks like subdivision 15 lines 5.27 to 5.31, and Senator Rest is making the motion to delete that subdivision 15. Senator Dames, or did you want to speak first to your, I'm sorry, Senator Rest, first to speak to that.
Senator Dames, I think that that's a better way of continuing to work on how the thing would be paid for, rather than leaving it in and having a roll call vote here. Specifically, what I think would be specifically not on the policy, but on the fee increase. And I understand that, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dames, that would not be your preference, but my opinion, that's a better way to go at this point. So just explaining why. It's not about the policy here, but about more discussion needs to occur along the way about the about how it's paid for, and better that the bill doesn't have it on to make sure that that discussion takes place.
Okay. And Senator Dames, I think that Senator Rest makes a very good point, and I'm thinking that I would encourage you maybe to think about accepting that amendment. I would encourage you to do so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest and Senator Bonhoff, I'll look at that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we'll need to vote on that. So Senator Rest moves.
Mr. Chair. Okay. Okay.
Very yes. Good. This is an amendment, and then we'll come back to the so Senator Rest moves that subdivision 15, which is lines 5.27 to 5.31, be deleted. Is there any other discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. And the amendment prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you. I withdraw my request for a roll call. And Senator Rest, thank you for offering that. I actually think that was the wise thing to do.
Okay. All right. With that, any further discussion? Anybody else in the audience? Then seeing none, then Senator Dames moves that Senate File 752 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Transportation Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay.
No.
Nay.
And the motion prevails. That Senate File 752 as amended is recommended to pass and sent to the Transportation Committee. Okay. Thank you, Senator Dames. And then Senator Sparks. This one is the banking bill.
I'm going to set this aside.
Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 1735. I do, Mr. Chair, have an author's amendment. I believe it's the A1 amendment.
Okay, we'll pass out the A1 amendment. I'm sure members have that.
And Mr. Chair, as the staff is passing this amendment out, basically what this does is addresses some of the concerns the Department of Commerce had with the original bill. This is the preferred language, and that's the reason for the amendment.
All right. Senator Sparks moves adoption of the author's amendment, the A1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. And the motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And again, this is a bill relating to some banking issues. In the past, the Department of Commerce has brought forward a banking bill, and I've been honored and privileged to be able to carry that bill. This year, they did not choose to do that. But this bill basically does some clarifying and conforming legislation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think I would turn it over to Tess Rice with the Minnesota Bankers Association to give you a little bit more information on this legislation.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill
Welcome.
Does three things. The first thing has to do with when banks can be closed. Banks are allowed to close on federal holidays, but our statute is unclear as to whether they can be closed on a Saturday preceding a holiday or following a Friday holiday. And so our bill would allow them to be closed if they so chose following a Friday holiday or preceding a Sunday or Monday holiday. The next issue has to do with a Dodd-Frank conformance. Dodd-Frank repealed Regulation Q, which prohibited banks from paying interest on demand deposits, so checking accounts. And we have a state statute that still prohibits that, that is modeled on the federal language. And so our state statute would be repealed and banks would be allowed to pay interest on demand deposits. The third issue has to do with Dodd-Frank as well. Dodd-Frank changed the lending limit statute for national banks to regulate derivatives, how much exposure a bank could have to derivatives. Our state statute does not address that issue, and Dodd-Frank requires all states to do that by January 21st of 2013. So our bill would regulate derivatives.
Okay. Any question? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks and Ms. Rice, I'm most interested in Section 1, and I'm wondering, very curious as to why we legislate when banks can have holidays. What's the
good question?
There must have been some reason behind that. I'd just be interested to know why that is.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe it goes back to the Depression era, where they were worried about banks closing and people not being able to get access to their funds. And so banks are very restricted in when they can close. So, for example, if your bank president dies and you have a funeral, you can't close that bank. You need to be open for all regular services. Our statute will allow them to be closed on federal holidays, but it says it addresses Saturdays, but it's just unclear. And some of our out-of-state banks would like to be able to be closed. I really don't think it'll happen much in the metro because of all the competition, but I think out-state, they'd just like the option. The next time it will even apply would be July 5th of 2014, so it's something that would occur very irregularly.
Okay. Senator Brown. Ms. Rice, is this something we should look at just sunsetting altogether? I mean, the fact that we have legislation dictating when banks can be open and closed just seems strange to me, but I don't know if you have an opinion on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I think it probably still has a reason for being there. People do want to be able to access their money, and you're right, in an internet age with ATMs, maybe it's not as important, but I have not heard of anyone changing this at the state level yet.
Well, Senator Brown, I make an issue out of it.
But. Yeah, I think there's I'm sure, a historical track record. I agree with you. I mean, why are we regulating something like that? But I believe that just historically, the nature of banks and people having access to their money, and I think I'm sure at some point in time there was some proposals to make sure they were open so people had access to their money. But, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks and Ms. Rice, I do support the bill, but I just have a question. Could you tell us where we are in the implementation of Dodd-Frank? Isn't it still kind of pretty up for discussion whether or not it really will be implemented? What do you predict? Just share your thoughts about the current status of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, some things are effective already. So, for example, Part 2 of our bill with the repeal of the prohibition on paying interest on demand deposits was effective back in July. Hmm. So some things are happening already, but you're right. The bulk of it is being implemented by the CFPB or the SEC, and some of those rules haven't been written yet. I think the CFPB's come out with their first rule, so it has been a very slow process. I haven't heard that it will be repealed.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Further discussion? Then is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on the bill? Then seeing none, let's see, Senator Sparks, this is going to be you're just going to send this to the general orders then, right? There's no other committee stops for this bill.
Okay. Then I would move, Mr. Chair, that Senate File 1735 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay, members. Heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails. And the bill is recommended to pass and sent to general orders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
members.
Thank you, Senator Sparks. Okay, the next, we're going to take up my bill. I have some actual civilians to testify here.
Committee now has before it Senate File 1572. Senator Gerlach.
Good morning, members. The bill today before you, I can safely say that I do not expect, unlike my previous bills, there to be people lining up outside the door to testify on this one. And the reason is this is a very good bill that has garnered bipartisan support, and I can't think of a reason why we would not want to overwhelmingly pass this bill this year. Here's the situation. About a year ago, Mr. Steve Young, who many of you may know from a lot of his public policy work over the years, but he came to me and he said he's been working on this issue actually the year prior to that with Senator John Marty, and that they had held some meetings on it. And the problem they were trying to solve is a gap in our corporate structures that we have between for-profit corporations and nonprofits. They have their strengths and their weaknesses, and there's a gap in the middle. And we'll talk about what some of those are and how this bill solves that problem by attracting capital to a new type of a corporate entity called a benefit corporation, a public benefit corporation, or a B Corp, as it is oftentimes called. And that that new corporate structure will allow for, I'll tell you very briefly, and then we'll have some people go into greater detail, but it will allow some relief from a for-profit C corporation where the profit motive is number one, and the directors and the management of the company must, of course, seek profits and return to shareholders or be potentially liable for a shareholder lawsuit for malfeasance. And then also on the other side of the spectrum, the nonprofits who can't develop oftentimes a long-term strategic business plan for sustainability because they can't have working capital, or they can't build that up, and they can't use some of the aspects of a corporate structure to enhance their mission. So it takes elements from both of those together and puts them together so that we can attract some private sector investment into this new entity. That is it in a very broad nutshell. And I think first what we're going to do is have Mr. Steve Young explain his role in this and how this came to be and what it's going to do. Also, we're going to have some examples for some people who can take advantage of this, what I believe will be a new sector in our economy. So, Mr. Young.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Steve Young of St. Paul, Global Executive Director of the CO, CAUX Roundtable. And our work at the CO Roundtable has been in the area of corporate social responsibility and business ethics. And I have been thinking about, if you will, the problem of free markets and capitalism for quite a while. And in 2004, I wrote a book that was published out of San Francisco called Moral Capitalism. And the challenge, as we all know, is how do we take advantage of the incredible capacity of individuals and free markets to achieve things and at the same time address our common good, the public interest, the common good, the public goods, things like that. And as we all know, sometimes the system works well and sometimes it doesn't work so well. In the last 4 or 5 years, there has been increasing discussion. Professor Michael Porter of Harvard wrote an article last year called Shared Value. The Catholic Church, Pope Benedict, has been talking in his encyclicals about how you use market opportunities in order to achieve a wider range of outcomes. And the thought then emerged that legally, we have, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon jurisdictions, we have limited ourselves. Because we've only authorized two different kinds of entities, as the chairman said. On the one hand, we have for-profit corporations, which are designed around the concept of ownership, where you can sell stock, people own the corporation, and the function of that corporation is to generate profit for the owners. On the other hand, we created, and I think more a function of the 20th century, out of a notion of charity, and serving the public good, we created not-for-profit entities, which we call corporations, but they're really, if we think about it, quite different. These entities have no owners. They have a membership base, but they're primarily run by a board of directors, which is committed to achieving certain goals. And they are funded through donations. And if they can get a lot of philanthropic support, they can build up some reserves. But fundamentally, they live off whatever the donors can give them. The phrase that comes to mind, actually, is that associated with Blanche DuBois in the famous movie Streetcar Named Desire, when towards the end she is asked how she takes care of herself, and she turns and she says, "I have always relied on the kindness of strangers." And as one who has run nonprofits.
Use that line at the start.
I was concerned for the dignity of my colleague. I've run a number of nonprofits and been on boards of others, and may I say, and in today's circumstances, it's tougher than ever. To raise operating funds is very, very difficult. We have a gap where we are not being able to direct the capital of which our society is so blessed and with which Minnesota is so blessed to taking care of a lot of needs. For example, just this morning at a previous meeting, I ran into someone who's with a group in North Minneapolis. There are 1,000 empty homes in North Minneapolis. If they are allowed to deteriorate and those properties are allowed to deteriorate, it is not a situation that any of us would be proud of or would welcome. Where do you get the capital to buy up 1,000 empty homes, refurbish them, and bring them back into the market? It's not something that for-profit entities are particularly eager to do, given risk factors and things like that. And in order for a not-for-profit to do it, you have to convince some donor to give you $5, $10 million. And when the donor gives over money to a not-for-profit, they surrender all the money. It's a gift. It's charity. The concept of a benefit corporation is to go in the middle, into the gap, where somebody, because they believe in the cause, in the mission, in the good of the outcome, would put their private wealth to the service of some good, and they would still be an owner of that wealth, which means that it could be devised to children, it could be granted to somebody else. They could earn a return on this wealth. So it's not like they have to sacrifice current income when they give away part of their net assets. And the capital then gets devoted to an enterprise which can earn income. If we think about many of the activities which add to the quality of our life, education, culture, these are actually income-earning activities. We pay money. We pay money to go to museums. We pay money to go to theaters. We pay money to get educated. Healthcare. Think of all the things that the state actually helps subsidize, which are delivered through private entities, which, however, are funded. If we could somehow arrange legally for people to donate private capital into situations where income can be earned, we should be able to increase significantly the amount of capital in our society which is being devoted to providing various kinds of services. This movement has a lot of solid support behind it. Similar laws have been passed in Vermont, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, California, and Hawaii. And legislation is pending in Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And I have been talking to people on all sides of this, foundations and people with wealth who are looking for opportunities to put their money to good use but still earn something, talking to not-for-profit people who would like ways to get working capital. Recently I ran a Harvest Prep, a very distinguished charter school, would like to buy a new building. As a nonprofit, how does it raise the $5 to $10 million to go out and buy a building? We didn't design our nonprofits in order to really be run functional businesses. But Harvest Prep is not a for-profit corporation. Because, again, if you're a for-profit corporation, how can you get contributions from foundations, and how can you get a 501c3 tax status? So I think this particular proposal of Senator Gerlach's is actually a stroke of genius. And secondly, it's a very small piece of legislation, but it has profound and positive implications.
Okay.
Senator Genius.
far too generous and far too kind. Also, Mr. Chris Hansen, who runs a business for some years and was with us at our press conference yesterday and has a story to tell, so I'd asked him to come and share it with the committee.
Thank you,
welcome
Senator.
To the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the
yes,
record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Chris Hansen, co-founder and CEO of the Data Bank, Inc. We're a software company in Minneapolis. In the last 30 years, I've been involved with founding or co-founding a half dozen businesses here in Minnesota. I've been part of companies that have received investment from private individuals. I've been a part of fast-growth companies that have received venture capital funding. And been very fortunate in my business career to be successful in a lot of different ways. In 1998, my business partner and I came up with an idea to create a for-profit company that had a mission of creating positive social change through technology. So we had this vision of a for-profit business that had a social mission. Some of you might remember the investment environment in 1998. If you were an internet company, you could essentially get millions of dollars for an idea written on a napkin. And we went out into the investment community here in the Twin Cities with our idea for a software company that was internet-based. And we didn't just get rejections. Primarily, we got blank stares because the investment community didn't know how to react to a company like ours where we were a for-profit company. We could show that they would get a positive return on their investment. But we also had this social mission. So they were conflicted. They were concerned that business decisions in our company were not going to be made to their best profit. And that's absolutely true. As a social venture, we make decisions based on a number of different criteria. Now, we were fortunate in that we were able to find four different individuals that were willing to take a gamble on the Data Bank and make a small investment in us. 13 years later, we have a successful small business, and those investors have been very encouraged by the progress and not only the financial return but also the social return that our company has achieved. Well, we've been talking a lot about the investment difficulties with this type of business. I think it's important also to point out that the communities need to create an infrastructure to support these types of businesses, banks, accountants, lawyers that can all work with these types of companies. And again, through quite a bit of work, we've been able to find at the Data Bank a bank, a law firm, an accounting firm that understands our business and have been strategic partners for us for quite a long time. 2 years ago, we went through a process to become a certified B Corporation. Now, this is a third-party entity out east that runs businesses through quite a stringent assessment process looking at financial criteria, environmental criteria, employment criteria, and community-based criteria to come up with a metric that shows a company's overall value as a business beyond just the shareholders but all stakeholders involved. Today we're one of three certified companies here in Minnesota, but we're part of a much larger growing segment of companies, over 2,000 across the country, that have gone through the assessment process. So, you know, here today, I'm here today to really encourage you to support this bill. You know, while this bill itself is not going to create any jobs, What it's going to do is provide opportunity. It's going to provide opportunity for entrepreneurs to create those benefit corporations and create meaningful, sustainable employment. It's going to create the opportunity for investors and other service providers, banks, lawyers, accountants, to provide investment and services to the benefit corporations where they can share in the success of those businesses. And most of all, it's going to create the opportunity for these businesses to address the many social, environmental, and economic issues that we're all faced with in our community. So I highly encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there further testimony?
Madam Chair, if I may introduce Mr. Rob Scarlett. Rob is an old friend from St. Paul who has been involved on the investment side, looking for opportunities. Investors who have money who want to put their money to both profitable use but also to have some kind of social value. Mr. Scarlett, please.
Madam
Welcome
Chair.
To the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please. For the
Madam
rest.
Chair, my name is Rob Scarlett. I'm here as a friendly witness and came in to point without portfolio, but I do serve on a foundation and very active in a movement, which this is a part of, to find impact investments. The foundation I sit on is very eagerly, and along with many others, looking for opportunities to invest in this type of vehicle where the mission is clear. It's a social mission, but where there's also the prospect of return. And I'm just here to point out that this is something that's going on nationwide. It's here in Minnesota. I work also to participate in the Minnesota Council and Foundation meetings, and there's a lot of talk within the foundation community on how they can devote some of their corpus, actually, into investments that yield a return but have specifically a very social mission as their objective.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions or comments from the members? Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the only difference here is really a definitional change in the law, allowing it to just not focus strictly on the profits, the fiduciary responsibility. And, of course, then the board, this would have to be submitted to the board and the shareholders if they want to say, transition from a LLC or an S-Corp or C-Corp to a call a PBC, correct?
Senator Gerlach.
That's correct, Madam Chair and Senator Chamberlain. It's more than just a simple definitional change. Conceptually, there's a couple of points. One is a broadening of what a stakeholder is. In a for-profit corporation, the stakeholders are the investors, the shareholders. That is the people who have a stake in that company. What we're doing here is that with a benefit corporation, you're acknowledging that there is a broader set of stakeholders, and they're actually listed in the bill. It could be employees, customers, community of interest, or a creditor, it says. And the idea is that you can take into account other elements in what you're doing in your mission, and as a result of doing that, you may have a smaller return for what you'd normally give to shareholders, but that difference will be reinvested in some social purpose as defined by the mission of this benefit corporation. So it's more than just a definitional change. It's a fundamental way of doing this, and we also provide for the acknowledging that in a for-profit corporation, that board of directors is obligated to seek the highest profit possible, and that's fine and that's good, and that's what has played a significant role, obviously, in building our economy and the world economy. But one of the downsides is that if that is the sole purpose, then other pieces can be neglected or left on the table that maybe we want as a society to address through other means than just government always doing that, or just nonprofits, that there are ways to do this. And so what we do is we're providing that the directors are somewhat shielded from what could be a shareholder lawsuit if you're pursuing other things that are considered off track of the for-profit mission. So that is another fundamental change in concept of what a benefit corporation is about. And people know that going into this. Investors know that going into this. And so that is the point. So it's more than just definitional.
Okay. One follow-up, Madam Chair. Just wanted. So, yeah, thank you very much. So, and I'm assuming then all tax laws and all other laws remain the same. We're talking about this conceptual piece, correct? Okay.
Well, that is correct, Madam Chair and Senator Chamberlain. In fact, I'll tell you, there's a lot of references in this bill to existing corporate law.
Yep.
We didn't just reprint everything in here. In fact, we re-edited a version of this bill because we didn't want to just repeat a bunch of statute. We just said we're using the regular corporate statutes unless we say otherwise in the bill. Here's the differences.
Thank you.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gerlach, I was just curious if you had spoken with the Council of Nonprofits and if they had weighed in on this.
Madam Chair and Senator Eaton, I know that Mr. Young has, in fact, as we talked about this, developed this over the course of the past year, he has done a lot of the legwork in reaching out to the different groups, and so you might be able to answer that directly.
Mr. Young.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, Senator Gerlach, we have been talking to lots of people, and there's lots of interest. I think the council and foundations here in my few conversations are intrigued, but my experience has been there's something of a chicken and egg phenomenon. If there's not a present reality to really sort of think about, how do you consider that? I think what my interpretation from conversations with them is that they perceive a great need to attract more capital into what they're doing. And if this is a way that will do that, they're very willing to see it attempted. Whether it will work or not is going to depend on the interplay between investors on one side and entrepreneurs on the other.
Senator Eaton.
If I could add one point to that, Madam Chair. And Senator Eaton and committee members, I envision this really as creating these from three different directions. I think that you're going to have certainly the obvious people starting from scratch that are saying, I have this idea, and this is the route to go, and they're created from scratch. But also, you're going to have the nonprofit community looking at this, and you're going to have some of them saying, maybe this is a better model for what we're doing. And I think you'll have some migration of some nonprofits that say this is a better fit. And then you're going to have some for-profit corporations that are going to say, you know, we've really been struggling and wanting to do a particular social mission here, but we've been constrained. And I think you're going to see some for-profit corporations migrate over as well. So I see three directions coming from that. And people are going to choose, and this puts another option on the table for them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Eaton, a follow-up, and then
yes.
I'll call Mr. Young.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if anybody was concerned about the competition for funds and, from the nonprofit to the profitable proposal you have here.
Mr. Young.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, yes, that concern has come up in some conversations with, if I may say, a certain amount of tension. Because there is concern that if new entities come on, they may be more attractive than existing entities to, let's say, the McKnight Foundation, the Bush, et cetera, or to wealthy individual donors. On the other hand, the current structure, and I'm also speaking very much from my own personal experience and point of view, the current structure has some very serious limitations because given the way philanthropy has evolved, providing for general operating expenses, overhead, is a very low priority. But that's actually what most nonprofits need. You need money for your core staff. You need rent. You need lights. You need phones. More and more donors over the last 30 years, they like to focus on outcomes and programs. So you, if you're running one of these organizations, very frequently are under the tension of trying to come up with a $100,000 program which has a 16% override, which goes to your general operating expenses. But to cover all that, you need six or seven different operating programs, and it's a stress and a strain. You have no working capital. Secondly, it's very hard to make any kind of long-term capital planning or capital investment. If you're very lucky, you might get a three-year grant from McKnight, but they will probably phase it out over 3 years. So in year one and a half, the executive director begins looking at his or her tie and sort of says, well, what do I do for follow-on? Can I commit to a staff person for more than this? These are the kinds of things that the for-profit corporation doesn't have to worry about because it can raise capital and it can have a more strategic impact. The other difficulty that nonprofits have is that Rome was not built in a day, and you can't achieve what you want in 6 months or a year or 18 months. Sometimes it might take 2 or 3 years to build up your reputation, to train your staff, et cetera, et cetera. How do you fund that? Therefore, we have seen in the last 20 years increasing efforts by nonprofits to do for-profit activities. A classic example of this is Minnesota Public Radio, where I am told that the for-profit side earns a lot more money than the not-for-profit side. And the for-profit community has been torn between are we really a for-profit, or are we a not-for-profit? You know, how do we do this? My particular feeling is that this thinking of a public benefit corporation simplifies that situation and says if you are in a position where you can attract some income, you can then go out to either perhaps the existing foundations or a new set of donors. You're bringing in new capital over and above what's out there already on the grant-making side. And I think there are also, as Mr. Scarlett was commenting, there are potential donors out there who would bring more capital in. So this should end up as a win-win for everybody.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 1572? Senator Gerlach, I notice that you don't specify an effective date, and I was wondering if that was on purpose or you just really do want just the general effective date of whatever it is. If there's no effective date, when is the bill?
Madam Chair, I believe it'll be August 1st.
August 1st. Is that what you want so that any entity may choose this after August 1st, or did you have something else in mind?
No, I don't think so. August 1st is good. I think you did. Because there's time. Madam Chair, we did talk about this at one of our meetings, and I think that because of the ramp-up time and the publicity required for something like this, should it pass, it's nothing that's going to happen with the snap of a fingers anyway. So we just didn't see the need we would need to expedite it with an effective date, and that August 1st, the normal default date, was just fine.
Okay. And Senator Gerlach, you don't think you needed – I was thinking more of an extended time rather than August 1st. Do you think that the word would get out enough so that August 1st is not too soon?
Yes, Madam Chair. No, I don't think it's too soon. There's nothing. There's no agencies that need to prepare. There's nothing really to prepare on that. But like I say, and there just didn't seem a need to expedite it either because of the ramp-up time for someone to take advantage of it. And it just seemed the normal August 1st default date was just fine.
I understand from staff that the bill needs to be, if it's acted on favorably, needs to go to the Judiciary Committee.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So Senator Gerlach moves that with no further discussion. And is there anyone before we take action, is there anyone in the audience in the room who wishes to add any further comment or testimony on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Gerlach moves that Senate file number 1572 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you so much. Is there further business? There being no further business, the committee's adjourned.